Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Signs with Ann Fisher. I'm Gail Hogan filling in for Ann this week. Netflix, Hulu, Amazon Prime. For those who have cut the cable cord, there are plenty of ways to watch TV. This has been seen as a good way to save money on the monthly cable bill. But as the options expand, consumers will have to pay more if they want to have it all. Disney recently announced that they are going to be pulling their content from Netflix and create their own streaming service. Joining us is technology reporter for The Washington Post, Haley Sukiyama. Hi, Haley.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. Let's talk about this Disney deal. Why is this so significant in the streaming world?
Yeah, so I think it's significant for a couple of reasons. If you're looking at the entertainment industry itself, right, it's interesting to see Disney, which, you know, they're a content creator, right? They make the shows, they make the movies that we all watch. It's interesting to see them sort of take control of their own streaming technology and kind of say, this is a service that we're going to provide. You know, that's sort of unusual. We've seen HBO do that. We've seen a couple of channels do that, but certainly no one as big as Disney. So from the business side, that's pretty interesting. And then from the consumer side, what is interesting and maybe a little troubling is to see them say, you know, what we're going to do is we're going to pull our content out of Netflix, which is something you may already pay for in order, in part, to watch Disney shows and movies, and then we're going to put it in its own streaming service. So if you're a parent or just a person who likes Disney, now you have to say, okay, well, do I want to keep my Netflix and pay for this other streaming service? Do I switch? So it becomes a little more complicated.
For Disney, I'm sure for them, and they are a business behemoth, they'd rather have control, right?
They'd rather have control, and I'm pretty sure the subscription numbers sound pretty good to them, too.
So will this hurt Netflix?
So that's a really interesting question. I mean, so we've seen Netflix kind of make this push into these original shows, right, that they're funding, Orange is the New Black, you know, House of Cards. So I think what Netflix is trying to do is say, well, hey, if we're going to have content, I mean, they've obviously seen the writing on the wall, right? They're saying if we see these studios that are going to make their own services, then we're going to try and make our own original programming. So that puts a lot of pressure on that aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, if they lost all of their content, you know, to a variety of streaming services, that would be a bad thing. But to see one big company pull out, you know, that's going to be really interesting to kind of see how they navigate the next couple of years.
It's so wild to watch what's going on in the world of television. How are the traditional TV stations, NBC, CBS, ABC, how are they reacting to the rise of streaming video?
Yeah, and so that's also been really fascinating. I think we've seen, you know, everyone's kind of watching, you know, to see sort of what consumers are doing, right? And I think what we've seen, some of these, so a lot of them are putting, you know, they're putting their shows online in some capacity, right? Either you have to sign in with your cable provider, you know, log in order to get their content. Sometimes you can just watch it for free. And then CBS in particular has been doing something interesting. They have a service called CBS All Access, where they're releasing original shows just for that subscription service, which is paid. So the sequel to The Good Wife, for example, called The Good Fight, is only available as this kind of paid tier of CBS, which is, of course, the channel that we are all used to getting for free over our bunny ear antennas. So It's been interesting to watch.
Well, what's the impact then on cable companies? Obviously, broadcast is looking to where they fit in the shuffle anymore. What about cable companies?
Yeah, so cable companies are also trying to figure out, you know, I think what they're looking at is they're saying, okay, you know, what kind of bundles can we offer that are, you know, more appealing to consumers? Because sort of their advantage, as it were, for the cable companies is sort of, as we talk about in the story that I wrote, you know, if all of these streaming services have, you know, if you're trying to figure out what's in each catalog and it gets very confusing, what the cable companies can offer is simplicity. So they can say, just pay us once and you'll get all your stuff that you want, right? So I think they're looking at how to tailor bundles of channels to consumers a little more tightly, right? If you're a sports fan, if you're, you know, it's what they call a skinny bundle. But it's difficult for them. You know, they have a lot of traditional agreements that they have to abide by. And so
that have years on them, contracts with long years. Yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, about what they have to carry in order to carry another channel or something like that.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides, and we're talking about streaming video and the future of TV with technology reporter for The Washington Post, Haley Sukiyama. If you have a question or comment, give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email allsides@wosu.org. I'm wondering, is cable ever going to allow, or will there be that possibility of streaming services on cable so that the two would ever combine, or vice versa?
You know, that's a really good question. Right now it seems like they are, these are two parts of the industry that are not getting along. So I think it would require a lot of negotiation to see. You know, what we are seeing is some of the tech companies or some of the, we're seeing kind of other businesses pop up and try to make it easier to almost act as consultants, entertainment consultants for consumers to say, this is what you need and, you know, this is sort of how you should subscribe to it, and they try to bundle it together. Wow. There's been rumors for years that Apple is trying to, you know, make it easy through the Apple TV to just say, okay, I'm going to subscribe to this, you know, and this and this through Apple, and then you kind of pay one bill and you get all these services. But it's incredibly difficult.
Shonda Rhimes is the creator of ABC's Grey's Anatomy, Scandal, How to Get Away with Murder. Now, she recently made a deal with Netflix. Top talent is going to Netflix. And, you know, if we've watched the Emmy Awards lately, you know that the top shows and the actors and actresses are all from a lot of streaming services. Why is top talent flocking to Netflix?
Well, I think in some ways it's money, right? There's a lot of money that Netflix and Amazon and Hulu are all kind of throwing at this original content push that they're making. I think it's kind of an interesting idea, right? If you're a top talent and, you know, you kind of have your pick of the litter, it's kind of fun to play around with new formats and kind of see, you know, new models of distribution. So I think because it is sort of experimental, that's interesting. And then there's also just a lot of money flowing into it.
And I think they have more storyline capability and things they can do on streaming that you can't do on broadcast TV, things of that sort.
Absolutely, yeah.
How has that streaming option then changed viewer habits?
So definitely we're seeing more people subscribe to multiple streaming services, right? And that's been interesting to see. You know, that's been a pretty steady amount of growth. And so it is interesting because people say, okay, I'm going to cut the cord and I'm just going to pay Netflix, cut the cable cord and I'm just going to pay Netflix. But then it's like, oh, I'm also going to get, you know, Hulu, and I'm also going to get Amazon. And, you know, certainly in our household, it's grown to like 6 or 7 streaming services at any given point. And it's like, am I really saving that much money for cable? I don't know anymore.
And how do these companies make money? Obviously, they're charging you, but there's no advertising. They're paying top talent. But obviously, somebody's making money or they wouldn't keep coming up with original shows with top-tier talent.
Yeah. So it's a lot of the sort of the licensing distribution kind of deals, subscriptions, obviously. They're getting a lot of subscription money, and that's why they're so focused on growing their subscriber base, right? If you look at any sort of the information they release, it's all about growth. They're trying to get into new markets. So.
I'm curious as to what ages buy into the streaming. And I'm only speaking for my own kids who are millennials. They really don't watch much mainstream TV. They subscribe to streaming services, and that seems to be it. So is it an age thing, too?
It is in some part. I think, you know, we've seen a majority now of, I think we just passed the halfway mark according to Nielsen. A majority of households do have at least one of these subscription video services, but you definitely see the percentages higher in millennial houses as opposed to, you know, kind of Gen X houses or kind of boomer households. But it is fairly common now across all age groups.
And at some point, this streaming is getting more and more expensive if you get more and more streaming services. As you said, you have, 5 or 6, becomes cost prohibitive. And so how are all these services going to be able to stay competitive? Or is this one of those things where the cream rises to the top and that's how it'll work?
You know, I really think it is going to be, this is just sort of speaking from my observations, but yeah, I think it is going to be it's going to be a fight, right? It's going to be interesting to see if, you know, if someone like Disney says, you know, if you're only subscribing for Disney content, if you're only subscribing for content from one producer, it'll be interesting to see how many of those the market can sustain, and, you know, sort of how that plays against these kind of bigger, I guess we could call them aggregators, but, you know, Netflix or Hulu or, you know, there are lots of kind of niche streaming services. There's one just for horror movies. There's one just for British television. So it'll be interesting to see how kind of those more specialized, but from many different content providers, how they evolve as well.
But remember in the beginning of cable, when the golf channel came on and people said, I can't believe there's a channel just dedicated to golf. And then it kind of went on and on and on. And it's the streaming services are doing the same thing.
Yeah. Exactly. And so, I mean, there will be some that, you know, they'll just find their audience, right?
Right.
They may not need millions and millions and millions of subscribers, but they're going to find the right people and they're going to find the right price and they're going to be happy sort of existing on a, you know, being a cult hit, as it were.
Well, before I let you go, do you know anything about Facebook and the fact that they say they're going to bring video and original content to an app, a Facebook app?
Yeah, so Facebook's push is really interesting. It's definitely more in the vein of kind of what we've seen YouTube do, Google's YouTube site do. They're sort of funding these short programs, short regular programs that we're going to see come out. Facebook, of course, has had a lot of problems with video, you know, with their live video. We've seen them kind of grapple with being able to monitor and curate the stuff
right.
that's on their site. And so I think by making this push, by having, you know, kind of scripted content, original content, that's them trying to raise the quality level of video on their site and then also, you know, kind of go after this snackable, you know, smartphone audience. So.
It will be interesting to see where it all goes.
Absolutely.
Haley Tsukiyama, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
More Tech Tuesday coming up. This is All Science with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Gail Hogan, sitting in for Ann. We're living in the era of the smartphone, where we are all connected to the web and social media all of the time. For many of us, this is still a technological wonder bordering on science fiction. But for the younger generation, the smartphone life is the new normal. The teenagers of today are living vastly different lives dominated by connected devices, and that could have serious consequences for their mental health. Joining us now is professor of psychology at San Diego State University, Jean Twenge. Her forthcoming book is called iGen, Why Today's Super-Connected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood. Welcome, Jean.
Thank you.
It doesn't sound good.
Oh, there's some good and some bad.
I'm sure. You focus on this generation that you call iGen. What ages are we talking about?
So iGen is born roughly 1995 through 2012. So they are today's kindergartners, five-year-olds through 22-year-olds.
And how are they different than the millennials, for example?
Well, they are the first generation to spend their entire adolescence with a smartphone. And that has had ripple effects across all areas of their lives, how they spend their time, their attitudes, and their mental health.
And what I hear from parents is that it's almost intuitive for these youngsters. They know how to use a smartphone or an iPad very young.
They do, and many iGeners get their first smartphone pretty young. There's not great statistics on this, but somewhere around, you know, fourth grade to seventh grade, iGeners already have phones. And that means that from a very early age, they're learning how to communicate through that phone. And moderate amount of use, that's fine. But by the time they're in high school, they tend to spend, from most surveys, 6 to 8 hours a day on that smartphone on average. And when you're spending that much leisure time on an activity, that's going to mean you're going to have little time left over for other things, such as getting together with your friends in person. And sure enough, iGen does that less.
And they're using smartphones, not the flip phones. So, I mean, there's a lot that they can do on those devices.
Right. So they're spending about 2 hours a day texting, a little less than 2 hours a day on social media, and about the same on online. So, it adds up to about 6 hours. Other studies have found about 8 hours. It's a lot of time.
Wow. So what are some of the mental health trends that you studied that trouble you?
Well, I've been researching generational differences for about 25 years now. And around 2012, I started to notice some more sudden and bigger changes than I was used to seeing. I was used to seeing generational changes that built over time, over 10 years or 20 years. And all of a sudden, there were these big spikes in symptoms of depression, in loneliness. Happiness started to go down. And then as I dug into that, I also started to see reports from other sources about increases in mental health issues. There's a big screening study sponsored by NIH that looks at clinical level depression among teens, and it found a 50% increase in the percentage of teens who fit the criteria for clinical level depression in just over a 6-year period. And then the suicide rate also started to increase around the same time for older teen girls. It's now at the highest rate since 1975. In my own analysis that I did for the book for iGen, I found that the suicide rate for girls between the ages of 12 and 14 has tripled over a 10-year period. So there's some pretty serious issues showing up, and they all kind of popped around the same time, around 2011 or 2012. And in trying to puzzle out, what might be happening around that time, I eventually came across the Pew Center survey finding that late 2012 was when the majority of Americans owned a smartphone.
What do you think is the connection then between depression and smartphones? Because aren't kids using them because they like to use them? It supposedly makes them happy.
Yeah, so it's a funny thing, because there's, a strange relationship that teens and adults, for that matter, have with their phones. Saw other research on this suggesting that our phones are addictive, that they employ the same brain chemicals, light up the same areas of the brain.
Like dopamine.
Dopamine, that's right, like drug addiction. And that means it becomes something that they don't necessarily always like, but they feel like they have to do it. And certainly that's what they're saying in these surveys, is that more of them are feeling these symptoms of depression, more feeling anxiety, more feeling loneliness. So clearly, it's not making them happy.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides, and we're talking about the impact of smartphone use on teenagers with Gene Twenge, author of iGen, Why Today's Super-Connected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood. If you have a question or comment, call 614-292-8513 or email allsides at wosu.org. Completely unprepared for adulthood. Now, how will a smartphone contribute to that?
Well, the smartphone accelerated some of the trends in this area, but these are cultural trends that have been going on for a long time, and they're not all bad. There's some trade-offs involved. So basically what we have is, you think about the things that adults do that children don't. They're all things that teens start to do when they're adolescents. So driving, working for pay, dating, having sex, going out without your parents, drinking alcohol. iGen teens are less likely to do those things than teens were just 10 years ago or 20 years ago. that trend started with the millennials, and then it really accelerated once the smartphone ended up on the scene. So some of those trends, most parents in particular would agree, are very good. We have fewer teens having sex and drinking alcohol. Yet it's a trade-off. It's not all good. There's a lot of things that I don't think fit into either category of bad or good, like driving and working. But all of those trends come together with a slower path to adulthood. And that has advantages, that we don't have as many teens getting pregnant and drinking. But it has some possible downsides if, and many, many managers and faculty members tell me this is exactly what's happening, if you get these 18-year-olds who then get into the workplace, get onto a college campus, and are not used to making their own decisions because they just haven't been independent.
And they can always use their phone for answers.
That may be part of it, yeah. So, you know, the smartphone probably accelerated some of those trends because a lot of them involve getting out of the house. And teens just get out of the house less, partially because the party's on Snapchat and they can, or over text, and they can communicate with their friends that way. And then that's also what a lot of college administrators have observed as well, is they get to college and, you know, not only do they not have experience with making their own decisions, they can bring mom and dad into that conversation through a text or through a quick phone call.
Right. And so hence there's the independent thinking is lost.
In some cases.
You wrote that the number of teens who get together with their friends nearly every day dropped by more than 40% from 2000 to 2015. What does that say to you?
Yeah. So that was one of the most interesting shifts in teens' time use, because we all know they're spending more time on their phones. But there have been some people who said, well, you know, that facilitates in-person social interactions. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't necessarily expect that to go down. But it has, quite strikingly, not just in that question about getting together with your friends, but pretty much across everything that teens do face-to-face and in-person, going to the movies, going to a shopping mall, going to a party, driving around in a car. Doesn't matter what the activity is. If it's in-person with their friends, you know, teens now do it less. So that may actually be one of the reasons why these mental health issues start showing up. It's not just that staring at a screen probably isn't good for mental health. It's that being together with people in person is good for mental health, and teens are doing that less.
And what's the difference from looking at a screen or even, I don't know, if you're looking at someone on the screen as opposed to meeting them in person?
Mm-hmm. Well, think about the way our human brains evolved over, you know, thousands of years. For the vast majority of that time, there were no screens. When you talk to people, it was face-to-face. And even today, if you compare the experience of communicating with people electronically versus being with them face-to-face, it's more emotionally fulfilling to be face-to-face with someone. Plus, teens who spend more hours of their day on screens are less happy, more likely to report mental health issues. And those who spend more time with friends in person show exactly the opposite, more happiness and less depression. And there's a couple studies, too, showing that, because my analyses were correlational, showing, you know, more closely that it's actually causation, following people over time and showing that social media use leads to less happiness, but less happiness doesn't necessarily lead to more social media use. So I think there's good reason to believe that screens are either a negative effect on mental health or at the most neutral. But we know from decades of research that face-to-face interaction really is one of the keys to mental health and happiness.
And you also say that electronic devices put kids at risk for suicide. What does the research say about that?
So we looked at a survey that looked at, it had risk factors like feeling sad and hopeless for more than 2 weeks, making a plan for suicide, seriously considering suicide, attempting suicide. Those are all obviously risk factors for suicide. And teens who spend more hours on screens, a higher percentage of them have one of those suicide risk factors compared to teens who spend, say, just an hour a day on screens. So that suggests that there's a link not just with happiness, but with these more serious mental health issues that including suicide risk. So, of course, again, that's correlation. It could be that the teens who are feeling suicidal are seeking out more time on screens, but these other studies suggest that that explanation doesn't fit most people's experience.
Is it that they are looking at other friends or acquaintances and it seems like their lives are better than theirs?
That could be part of it. So, you know, research is still ongoing to try to figure out the mechanisms behind why looking at a screen seems to be depressing, and comparing your life to other people, especially because social media pulls for this more positive view of yourself. That could be one of the things that's going on. There's one teen who I interviewed for the book who talked about how everybody is so positive on social media. She said, oh, everybody's saying, oh, I'm so grateful for my bestie. She said, no, you're not. Next week she's going to steal your boyfriend. You're going to claw each other's eyes out. That's the reality. And it just cracked me up. And it was nice to get that in-depth look from a teen who's experiencing this, because you know most of my data is based on these big anonymous surveys. So seeing that really play out with a teen seeing, you know, that's not reality, but that's what we see on the screen was very interesting.
And then I would assume cyberbullying comes into play here, especially if we're talking about teens and depression and suicide.
Absolutely. So bullying, whether it's in person or on a screen, is obviously related to those suicide risk factors, not surprisingly. Cyberbullying is a little worse. They're both bad. Cyberbullying is even more correlated with those suicide risk factors, because teens just can't get away from it. If they're bullied, you know, at school, that's bad enough, but at least they can come home and get away from it. But then if it's on a screen, especially on their smartphone, which teens are on so often, it's right there in their hand or in their pocket all the time.
And apparently then teens also have a false sense of being able to say what they want to say when they don't have to say it face to face. So they can say things that are mean and hurtful and feel like they can get away with it.
Yeah, that's right. And I think a lot of people do that, teens and adults, on social media through text, because even if it's not anonymous, when it's anonymous, it's even worse. Even when it's not anonymous, you're not looking the person in the eye and seeing their face collapse. You're not getting that feedback. You know, it feels like you're not even interacting with a real person because that person isn't there. So people do seem to be more cruel online and through electronic communication than they are face-to-face.
We're going to take a call now, Steve from Columbus. Steve, your question or comment for Jean, please. You're on the air.
Yes. She listed several different things that seem to correlate with the increase in young person phone use. I wonder if anyone has suggested that the crime rate may correlate also. We've explained some of the drop from the mid-90s to the present through policing changes and demographics and other factors, but there's a residual that seems unexplained, and one possible explanation is that the socialization patterns have changed due to phone use. Young crime is frequently a congregate sort of an activity. Mm-hmm. If they're not congregating, then it reduces the chance.
Interesting observation. Thank you for that, Steve. And your thoughts, Jean?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, there's a graph in my book, in iGen, showing the drop in the homicide rate, and then it's graphed against the increase in the suicide rate. And for the first time since those stats have been kept, for more than a five-year period, the suicide rate has been higher than the homicide rate for teens. And I think that's one tentative possible conclusion, is because teens aren't hanging out in groups anymore, then they're less likely to harm each other physically. They're also less likely to get in fights. So it's not just the extreme violence of homicide. It's also, you know, assault and just regular old teen fist fights, less likely to happen. But they can still bully each other through their smartphones. Mm-hmm. And that may be one of the reasons why the suicide rate is higher. So that was a very I think that's a very plausible idea, that at least part of that drop in youth crime might very well be due to the fact that they're at home on their phones being mean to each other that way rather than in person. And that obviously, you know, that has some good things about it, but the suicide rate is not so good, obviously.
Right. That's a negative effect. What can parents do then, Jean? What's your advice to them, especially if they have, you know, a youngster in kindergarten, first grade, a teenager? When do you get them a smartphone? How much do you let them use that smartphone?
Yeah. Well, I have three kids myself, so I've thought about this a lot. I think the first thing is to put off getting your child a smartphone as long as possible, just because of some of these influences. And some of these effects on mental health are larger for the younger teens. By the time, you know, they're in 10th grade or especially 12th grade, they're better able to emotionally handle some of these interactions. The second thing is, once they do get a smartphone, limit their use. So moderate use of an hour, even, you know, hour and a half or so a day, is not connected to mental health issues. So we don't need to be yanking the phones out of teens' hands. It just should be something we're using in moderation. And it goes for adults, too. So for teens, parents can put an app on their teen's phone to make sure that they are using it a moderate amount of time, say 90 minutes a day, just to pick a number. And those types of apps can also make sure that phone is turned off at night when their teens should be sleeping, because that's another factor we didn't even talk about. Teens are sleeping less, probably because they have their phones in arm's reach or even under their pillows most of the night.
So there are ways and there are devices for parents to help them with these things, and they should look into those, apparently.
That would be my suggestion. That's what I plan on doing with my own kids.
Well, good luck with that, Jean. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Jean Twenge is the author of iGen, Why Today's Super Connected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood. Tech Tuesday will continue. You're listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Gail Hogan. When it comes to classic video game characters, Atari had Pac-Man, Nintendo had Super Mario, and Sega Genesis had Sonic the Hedgehog. While those gaming systems are ancient history, the characters live on, and Sonic is back with a new game for fans of the original. Joining us now to talk about that and other tech news is Managing Editor of Android Central, Daniel Bader. Hi, Daniel. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me in.
I know there are people out there who may not remember Sonic the Hedgehog. So for those who can't remember, what was that appeal of the original game? What was it about?
Well, it was all about speed. I think back in the early days of consoles, the Sega Genesis was an outlet for a lot of young people to really let off a lot of pent-up energy. And Sonic the Hedgehog embodied that. It was incredibly fast. It used the momentum of, you know, this unique looking avatar to sort of let you go as quickly as possible on your television. And it was challenging. I mean, these games like Sonic, like Mega Man, a lot of Nintendo's earliest games, Final Fantasy, these are all extremely difficult games even today. And the challenge is something that people really feel nostalgic about. Games today are known to be much easier. They're meant to be much quicker to finish and to complete. So Sonic is one of those games that lives on because of its both aesthetic appeal. It's very unique in the way that it looks, but also in its challenge and its speed. So Sonic Mania is a game that was built from the ground up to try to recapture some of that nostalgia while giving players across the new consoles like Xbox, PlayStation 4, and Nintendo Switch a way to experience it completely new again, because this is not just a remaster, but this is a completely new game.
but there is nostalgia there. Some folks just like to think of what it was like back in the old days.
Yeah, you know, there's been a resurgence of nostalgia in video games. You see it a lot with Nintendo Switch. This is Nintendo's best and most successful console in over a decade. And a lot of the early titles really come out of that feeling of nostalgia. The first game that was released was a Zelda game, a Legend of Zelda, and it was a completely new game, but it sort of harkened back to that original feeling a lot of players had from the 1990s playing that Super Nintendo. And Sonic Mania does the same thing. You know, it brings that experience, the low, the sort of low bar to entry, but very, very quick ramp up of difficulty that came with these games. And the graphics, those pixelated, we call them sort of pixel art type graphics, those really capture the way that we thought about video games a couple decades ago. They were not photorealistic. They were completely animated and made up, and it was a fantastic feeling.
Well, whatever happened to Sega gaming consoles?
Well, Sega realized that it could not compete with the big kahunas out there, including Microsoft's Xbox and Sony's PlayStation, and it got rid of its consoles after the Dreamcast, which was really not well received. It had some great games on it, but it did not sell well. So Sega started to focus more on software, and it's now making games like Sonic and many others for both consoles and mobile devices. It's actually come out with a new service called Sega Forever, I believe, that allows you to play classic games on the iPhone and Android devices for free that are supported by ads. And this is a great way for people to play early Sega games like from the Genesis and beyond that they may not have tried before with no money down. And it's proven to be extremely successful.
You alluded to why people want to play some of these classic games because of the fact that they start off slow and build quickly. But the graphics on video games these days are so impressive. Why would somebody want to go back to the old stuff when the other stuff looks so good?
I don't really know the answer. I can only speak for myself. There's a definite connection to my childhood when I play something like Sonic Mania, and it's in no way a negative association. You know, these games, they may not hold up to scrutiny 20 years after the fact, but the memories do. And I think that's really it harkens back to a simpler time, and we have, you know, we can play violent first-person shooters all we want, and we can get that experience of the real world. But the games that have these old-world graphics, the ones that came straight out of the imaginations of many of these early video game developers, they speak to a sort of primal place in our souls, in our minds. And for myself, I can only say that I derive a lot of enjoyment from games that don't look photorealistic.
Well, a change of subject here. Amazon was the first to bring the smart speaker technology to the masses with their Echo line, and other tech companies are using Amazon software for their designs. What about this Genie? What's this smart speaker about?
So the Genie is a really interesting product. It's a speaker that is cheaper than Amazon's cheapest Echo. So Amazon sells an Echo Dot for around $50, although it goes on sale every now and then. But this Genie is made by a company called Anker, and it's using the same idea of the Echo Dot. It's a very small puck-like product that you put in your living room or your kitchen, and it gives you access to Amazon Alexa. And this is something that more and more people in the mainstream are getting to know, this idea that Alexa is living with you anywhere you are. And I say, and I apologize if I've activated anybody's Echo speakers by just saying that word, but I'm sure I've done it for a few of you, and I'm sorry about that. But it really is a ubiquitous speaker that allows you to do a lot of things, from turn off and on your smart lights to get the weather and the latest news. And this lowers the bar even more. It's a $30 speaker that sounds pretty good. It's not great, but Amazon wants everybody to access Alexa, whether it's using its $179 mainstream Echo or a cheap third-party option from a from another company, regardless, you get the same experience.
Well, why would the Amazon, one other company's building their speakers with Alexa technology? Why wouldn't they want to just keep it to themselves?
Right. And this is Amazon's strategy. So Amazon is not a hardware company. It's an e-commerce company that wants to sell you things. That is its primary business model. And getting Alexa into as many homes as possible using cheap hardware from third-party companies, that is imperative to ensuring that people of any socioeconomic place can access this service. So increasingly, you're seeing Alexa built into smartphones. A new phone from HTC actually has an app that you can activate just saying the hot word, and it'll allow you to do anything you can on your speaker. This is the same idea. It really makes it cheap and easy to access all of these services. And, oh, by the way, if you do want to listen to a song or, you know, this show, you can. It's really easy to call up music, podcasts, live radio, anything you want. And if you don't need a really great sounding speaker, if you just want to use it to hear the weather and the occasional news, this is a perfect example of that. And it's so cheap. It's kind of a buy it and forget it type of thing.
Well, I think by the mere fact that they're making it less expensive is that they want it to become a standard part in American homes. Do you see people really coming to utilize that as something that they need, not just want?
Yeah. So a lot of people, we talked about this around the Prime Day, this idea that Amazon wants to utilize its Alexa, platform to make it easier for people to buy things, but also make it cheaper when you use the voice itself. So what that means is that they're incentivizing people to invest in this platform by making voice-only products available at certain times of the year. And that does go from a want to a need. But at the same time, the longer you have this product in your home, the more necessary and integral and intertwined it becomes in your family life. And I can speak for myself. I use it every day to listen to a number of, early morning podcasts and news shows. I then, while I'm making breakfast, I turn on some music. And throughout the day, I'm always talking to it, whether it's to ask, how soon it's going to rain, if I see some clouds outside or any number of things. It becomes second nature. And then, oh, by the way, if I want to pick up some paper towels, if I run out, you can easily do that as well. And this is, for many people, it just becomes a regular part of their daily routine to ask Amazon's platform to do this for them.
So the more you use it, the more you need it.
Yeah, and this is it's the stickiness factor. And Amazon really wants this to be a sticky product, something that you use once, you get those that dopamine hit of, oh, it answered my question properly. That magical feeling of asking it to get you more paper towel, and then 9 hours later, it's at your front door. This is the kind of thing that Alexa does really well, because the system was set up from the get-go. And you remember, this has been around since 2014. So Amazon has perfected the method of ordering products and having them delivered to your front door, and it's only getting more seamless. So this is going to improve. And the other thing, too, is unlike a smartphone that you want to replace every couple of years, this is a software-based platform. So Amazon can update it in the background without forcing you to buy new hardware every couple of years.
Wow. Well, it was recently reported Google pays Apple billions of dollars a year to be on the iPhone. What do we know about this deal between Google and Apple?
Well, this has been a long-term deal. Every year since the iPhone came out in 2007, Google has been the number one and the primary search partner for Apple. And there have been years where it was expected Google would be replaced by Microsoft Bing, mm-hmm. and or Yahoo search, but Google has stayed as the primary search engine. Even though Siri uses Bing for a number of its results, along with another service called Wolf from Alpha. But Google, if you type into the Safari, mobile Safari search bar, you get Google results. And this year, because Apple is Apple and it can negotiate such incredibly high prices for an ecosystem that has upwards of a billion devices in use, the number is expected to be 3 billion for the next year. And that's going to continue to rise as Google wants to maintain its stronghold on the search market.
So it looks like it's a win-win for both companies.
Well, yeah, I mean, $3 billion is a lot of money, but for Google, it's a drop in the bucket compared to what they would lose if they were no longer on the iPhone. I mean, if you think about it, Google has two strategies around mobile search. One is it owns Android. It builds Android and gives it away for free to companies like Samsung and LG to put on their phones. And when Google does that, it makes sure that it is the primary search engine. If you want access to other services on those Android phones like Gmail and Google Maps, which are integral to many people's lives, you have to integrate a Google search bar. It has to actually be on the home screen. That's part of the deal. But with the iPhone, there is no such prerequisite. So Google goes into these negotiations at a disadvantage because Apple can say, well, Microsoft's also our friend, also our partner, and it's offering a ton of money to be the main search provider in mobile Safari. And no, not that many people use Bing compared to Google, but it's a very competent search engine. And there's others like DuckDuckGo, which is not as well known, but it's still very good. And Yahoo search is still a thing. So that's something that Google has to contend with each year. And as more people use the iPhone, it becomes increasingly difficult and more expensive to maintain its position on that coveted home screen.
But what would you expect for the consumer? They're used to Google. And even though you say these other search engines are capable, would users put up with it?
Well, users would likely have a choice. So this would be a default search engine, which means that if you typed in something into the search bar, you know, paper towel or Amazon or anything, it would automatically go it would give you results from Bing. But you could always go to google.com and then use the search engine that way. Apple would never prevent you from doing that. But it's this low bar to entry, and it's that reduced friction that is so valuable to Google, because that's how people access search on their browsers. They, you know, so many millions of people use Google Chrome as their main search engine, and as their main internet browser. And obviously, if you type something into the search bar on Chrome, it goes to Google search. That's the default behavior. So many people are used to that, they would probably be quite unhappy if that changed anytime soon.
And I just bought a Google phone. I bought the Pixel. So how important is the search engine to Google's bottom line? Because it seems like they're diversing.
Right. So Google is it's still incredibly reliant on the revenue from search. And increasingly, mobile search is becoming the number one revenue source for its ad business. And that means that throughout the last 5 or so years, the transition from desktop-based search to mobile has forced Google to spend money where it needs to maintain its dominance. And that is not going to change anytime soon. Google doesn't really make a lot of money from selling phones, and it makes no money from selling Android because, as I said, it gives it away for free. It's an open-source project. But alongside that, there are services like Google Search and Gmail and Google Maps that provide very relevant and targeted search results to millions and billions of users every day. And that's not going to change. So this is not getting any easier for Google. What it means is that dominance requires spending a lot of money.
Daniel, thank you. Daniel Bader, thank you for joining us. This has been Tech Tuesday.
Pleasure.
Yes, it's good to talk to you. This is All Size with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.